You're listening to episode 34 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with IGN editor-in-chief Steve Butts. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Julia.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
All right, we've got a guest with us today, as you guessed by the intro episode music. But before we get to introducing him, I want to plug two things real quick, and you'll understand why I'm plugging them before I introduce them here in a moment. Both of these are related to the upcoming MMO Pathfinder Online. First of all, if you are in the alpha for that and are looking for a guild to join, Fear the Boot has loosely thrown in its lot with a guild called Cabal, so that's spelled with a K. And so right now we're trying to get anyone that we can to back them and apply for their guild simply to back their play on the Land Rush, which is basically the first grab for territory, because they've offered us some pretty sweet deals, including some general autonomy. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. The second thing is keep your eyes on the show and the show notes in the future, because I'm still working out the details with the guys over at Goblin Works, but they're working right now on doing a Pathfinder Online Fear the Boot crossover where they're going to give us a stack of alpha codes, even for people that haven't backed the game. So you guys can come in, interact with us, see the game, and then both some of us and also some people from Goblin Works, and I'm trying to get some people from Paizo as well, from the tabletop role-playing side of like Pathfinder, to be on there, and we can talk with you guys and answer questions and just BS and socialize about whatever. And I don't have the details yet, but we're looking at doing this the weekend after Gen Con, which I think is the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th of August. So stick with us for that. All right, so the reason I did not introduce our guest before is because I did not want to send the message that he is endorsing any of this, because who we have with us today is Steve Butts, who is the editor-in-chief of IGN.
Hello, everybody.
And Steve, the reason I didn't bring you in before is because obviously being from IGN, I realize that your guys' endorsements and reviews and such are part of the commodity you sell. So I didn't want to blur the lines there. But I do have to ask one question before we get your resume out of you. Is there any joke about your name that's not already been made that we need to just go ahead and get out of the way now?
No, I think by this point they're all pretty well made. But I got to say, growing up is nothing compared to being a professional who actually has to expose himself and be visible to the internet community. YouTube is way worse than high school was as far as my name goes.
You know, actually, speaking of YouTube, are you familiar with the book Flowers for Algernon?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so for anyone who's not, Flowers for Algernon
is a wonderful book. You should turn this off and go read it right now.
Yeah, you probably should, and then come back. We'll still be here. But Flowers for Algernon is a book written in the first person by a guy named Charlie Gordon, who starts off suffering from a severe mental handicap, and they do a medical experiment on him that turns him into a super genius. And the entire book is written in the first person as his journal. So, of course, it starts off when he's got a very, very low IQ, and excuse the phrase, but is mentally retarded. And when I've been trying to sell this book to people lately, I've been like, well, yeah, it's kind of hard to read. And actually, no, it's not. If you've been on YouTube, you'll make perfect sense out of every page. So, all righty. So, Steve, could you give us a little bit of resume of who you are, both professionally and non-professionally, unprofessionally, if you prefer, just so our listeners have some idea of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. I'm a native of North Carolina. Grew up there in, I guess, junior high, it was called back then. I discovered role-playing games through a friend of my dad who came over to the house one night with a monster manual. And I had been a big fan of mythology and comic books and things like that. And I saw this guy had a book that was just full of all these pictures of griffins and hippocampi and all these monsters that I had read about with stats. And I thought, that's really interesting. It's sort of like a bestiary. And I wasn't really interested in the gaming part of it. But as I began to research the hobby, which, you know, back before the days of the internet meant, you know, going to hobby stores and talking to people who knew about it, I realized it was something I wanted to be into, asked my parents for a copy of the D&D Purple Box, and got it, and was a huge role player for many years. Played Call of Cthulhu, DC Heroes, Toon, basically anything I could get my hands on. Kind of fell out of that when I went to college because I developed other interests. In college, I studied history and archaeology because it was sort of part of this whole world that I had fallen in love with. And in college, roomed with a guy named Tal Blevins, who eventually left to found IGN. And he called me one day and said, look, we need a guy who understands war games and strategy games and history, and that's you. So we want you to come out here and work for us. So I joined IGN shortly after they founded in 1999. Did that for a good number of years, you know, worked there for a good long while. Left for a few years to work at The Escapist, but just recently came back to IGN a few years ago. And describing myself as a lapsed tabletop gamer, thought it'd be a great thing for the staff here if we also got involved in playing non-digital games with each other, and decided to start up a Pathfinder campaign.
Nice.
Well, let me pause you right there. I've got a comment and a question. The sure. comment is, you actually just derailed one of my topics. So I was going to ask you, like, how did you become the editor in chief at IGN? That's got to be a cool story. And it turns out you just knew the guy. So there with that one.
Sure. Pure nepotism.
Nepotism. Yeah. Okie dokie. So there you go, folks. If you want the secret, it's nepotism.
Dan, don't be jealous.
But my question is, why? You said that you thought it was important to get your staff involved in a tabletop role-playing game, despite the fact that obviously what IGN is a video game review site primarily. Right. What did you feel was important about a tabletop role-playing game that you wanted to get these people involved in it?
Well, there's a couple of things. I feel like just professionally, since a lot of the D&D DNA is kind of in everything we do, it's important to understand the current state of what that game is right now. And I thought Pathfinder was a better system, so I thought, let's dig into that first. Mm-hmm. We're actually wrapping up a campaign now and deciding what system are we going to move to next. But I also felt it was important for people to engage with the interactive storytelling that RPGs allow, and to use that as sort of a mirror or a lens through which they can view the way the stories are told in digital games, in games like Skyrim or Knights of the Old Republic, something like that. And to also engage with the math, to understand the mechanics. You know, when you fire a gun in Fallout, you know, some of that's based on player skill, but some of it is based on just math and probability. And a lot of that is under the hood. And I think that's what people like about computer games, is they don't have to engage with that stuff. But I thought, for us professionally, it's worth us spending some time to figure out how all this works, how you balance encounters, what makes something feel like it has stakes for the player.
Do you feel in some ways like a video game, especially a story-heavy one, is a lot like a role-playing game, except the DM is, or GM is, much more finite in their ability to react to the player?
I do, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things we've noticed in our lunchtime campaign here, or I've noticed as a DM. I don't know how aware my players are of this, but if they decide to go to town A instead of town B, well, great. The NPC that I was going to put in town B that dropped the next plot hook for them, he's in town A right now. And that's not really possible with a scripted experience where the designer has to say, look, we've got to put these people where they are and put them on their dialogue scripts and on their quest chains based on what we think the player is going to do, as opposed to at the table where you can respond to that stuff in real time and say, I don't want my players to assault the Goblin Fortress right now, so I'm going to drop an NPC in the middle of the forest that they now have to save and take back to town.
And then you got Bethsoft, which just doesn't feel burdened by either. You know, actually, Chad got me into playing Bethsoft games on PC.
Which one are those?
That's like Fallout, Elder Scrolls, Skyrim. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact that you can get the fan-made mods, which fix all the broken quest chains and such. But let's dig into the history of this a little bit.
Sure.
But while we were prepping the show, I had Pat look up some dates for me because I didn't have my phone on me. The D&D Red Box was released in 1974. Pac-Man as the stand-up arcade was released in 1980. The Atari 2600 was released in 1977. And then if we look at where I'm going to peg the start of the popularization of PC gaming, I'm going to put it with the Apple IIe and the kind of early home model IBMs. Mm-hmm. Which we're talking about 1983. That was the release date of the Apple IIe. And then, of course, after that came the Apple IIc and so on and so forth. But this is, you know, when you're talking about games like Bard's Tale, Wasteland, Legend of Quicksilver. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All role-playing games.
Yeah. Now, so yeah, here's the thing that I kind of took away from that. And you alluded to this yourself just a moment ago. I think it's inescapable that RPGs have very heavily informed video games. And I think that's something that in today's environment, where you can hide behind graphics and action in a way that you couldn't on these lower-end systems, these lower-end systems had to have more detailed decision-making because you couldn't make a big, pretty explosion. It's not to say that all stories today are shallow. I'm not by any means saying that. Last of Us, I think, had one of the best stories I've ever seen in any form of entertainment ever. But the point being that I think it is certainly inescapable that role-playing games informed the video gaming experience. The basic idea of characters, the basic idea of an invested storyline, decision-making, stats and attributes, the concept of hit points. You can go back to, for anyone who really remembers these old games, like Temple of Apshai, where they even had a system in there where you could recreate your own D&D character as he or she went through the Temple of Apshai, and it would give you paragraph text to look up and things like that. Steve, when did you get into role-playing games year-wise, and when did you get into video games?
So for me, video games was 1977, the year the Atari came out. I had a neighbor whose parents bought him one, and I decided, oh, we just also happened to coincidentally become best friends on this day. And my favorite game from that era was Adventure. There was something about that little yellow square. Right,
I like Tank
and the Duck.
Or no, yeah. Combat.
Combat was a great game, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the graphics in Adventure were just so ridiculously abstracted, and yet I had no problem losing myself in that world, and maybe it's because I was a little kid or whatever, but it's interesting. Sid Meier said at GDC Talk, he's the guy who made Civilization and Pirates and a lot of other great games. He said his favorite game was Seven Cities of Gold, and he said our technology has increased 1,000-fold since then, but the quality of our storytelling hasn't, right? It hasn't kept pace with sort of the technological development. And that's what I really got out of Adventure. Like, it was procedural sort of game, or it was dynamic, I guess I should say, on the third level where they just randomized the placement of items, and I invented my own story. So I got into that game very early on, like I said, 77, 78. And for me, I guess it was about 84 when my parents bought me my first D&D box set. I played in a campaign at a comic book convention the year before that I kind of liked. It almost turned me off, though, because I got there late and I ended up having to play the innkeeper's daughter, which for a 12-year-old boy is sort of like, oh, geez, I don't really know that I want to do this anymore.
I would.
It's interesting that the older games had very little in the way of graphical power. I mean, obviously, the hardware wasn't there and the programming languages and abilities and stuff were not there to make anything beyond just blocky shapes and such. But for these storytelling games, it's almost a good thing, because when you read a book and the book is filled with purple prose, with just piles and piles of words, your mind doesn't have to fill in all that much. You just kind of read it as a matter of course, and you get the story. But when you read a book that's very pared down, very lean, very well written, and very agile in its prose, your mind fills in so much of it.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing is true for any kind of storytelling.
This is
medium.
One of the reasons why, for me, one of the games I have played that had the most powerful story of any game I have played is XCOM.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because of the fact that, like most people, I downloaded a character editor. I was out there with my friends and family.
Yeah.
And pretty soon an emergent story started to come out of that. And my mind wrote a story that did not fully exist in the game and imagined scenarios that did not fully exist in the game. But, you know, Steve, you made a comment, and I'm curious, as someone who's, you know, really deep into the video game industry, why you think this is the case. And what I'm specifically asking about is, you said that as the technology has moved forward for the presentation, the storytelling has not kept pace with the leaps and bounds of presentation. Why do you think that's the case?
Oh, I think there are any number of reasons. I mean, one of them that I think is probably the most commonly accepted or commonly discussed in my circles, at least, is that as shelf space began to get more and more crowded, and as companies began to compete against each other in the marketplace, they realized that an initial hook for the gamer walking into the store was, if not a franchise that was very familiar, like Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, was going to be how the game looked. So you can put a screenshot on your box, and you can't put a story on your box. You can't put, you know, the sense of consequence or emergent storytelling that you get out of some of these games on a box and have it read well, or in a magazine ad, say, or in a trailer or something like that. So I think there was this push towards greater and greater levels of realism in the graphics. And a lot of game developers they seem to want to compete against Hollywood in terms of the legitimacy of the art form. You know, they want to be respected, and they feel like we can look more and more like the real world that people inhabit, even if it's a idealized or fantastical version of it, then that's one less barrier to people understanding that this is an art form worthy of their consideration. I don't happen to believe that. At least that's not true from my experience. For me,
are you Roger Ebert school of video games are not art?
Right. And I, frankly, I find that conversation tedious. I don't feel like, you know, for me, video games are a medium and not necessarily an art form, but they can be filled with arts, you know, storytelling and visual design and things like that. So it's like saying, is TV an art? Well, no, but things on TV can be art.
Yeah, I agree too. I think that video games on the whole are not necessarily art, but there are video games that are art. Like I think of something like, say, Proteus. Mm-hmm. Proteus is absolutely a work of art. It's barely a video game. And, you know, but it, yeah, they converge and they make something. Borderlands, on the other hand, is not art. It has great art in it, and it has wonderful, Borderlands 2 at least, has wonderful storytelling from Anthony Birch and all the other people who wrote it, but it isn't art.
And I think a lot of gamers have problems with this discussion because they're so desperate for some sort of legitimacy or some sort of recognition from the larger world outside that what we do matters. But if you look at this sort of cultural drift of modern history, at least in the US, we always see new technology and new entertainment forms being introduced side by side. And they're always dismissed by the older generation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. But of course, you know, gamers are getting older, game developers are getting older. They're starting, a lot of them, to become parents. And so the depth of the material that they can draw from when creating games is becoming richer, which is why you see something like The Last of Us, where there's a real human story at the heart of that game. And what really resonates with me is not the post-apocalyptic world that they've created, but just the sheer humanity of the characters and the decision they ultimately make, spoiler alert, to lie or not, to deceive somebody to protect them. I guess that's not too much of a spoiler, but at the end, there's a real sort of human decision that I can absolutely relate to. And I think the tendency of games in the late 90s and early 2000s to really focus on photorealism and cutting-edge graphics and polygon counts as sort of an end in itself completely ignores this notion that the player's imagination is also a resource to be leveraged very heavily. You know, you mentioned XCOM, and what makes XCOM special to players is not necessarily the game design or the world they've built. It's the fact that in hour 10, you're still living with the consequence of a decision that you made in hour 5, right? Absolutely. And you carry that with you, and it adds this extra layer of meaning and just sort of psychic resonance to the game, where you suddenly feel like this game is reflecting not just the designer's intentions, but who I am as a person and the things that I value. It's where I think EA's big franchise, The Sims, has gone wrong, because it used to be very toy box focused. Yeah. And the graphics were fairly, not simple for the time, but compared to today, they don't look like much. But as they began to get more and more distinct, and as the challenges began to be more and more driven by what the designer wanted you to do, the sort of, you know, stick and carrot approach they have to advancement in that game, the game suddenly felt less personal to me. Scott McCloud, in his book Understanding Comics, talks about sort of the levels of abstraction in art and how you can look at a smiley face and say, well, that could be anybody, including me. But you look at somebody like Joel from The Last of Us, you say, well, that's clearly not me. I don't look like that guy. So I'm playing another person, and it adds this extra layer of insulation between you and fully inhabiting this character that didn't exist when I was running around killing ducks as that little yellow square in Adventure.
You know, I'm struck by something that happened in like the comic book industry that is similar to this, where in video games, there was a period where it was big graphical push. Let's get 3D. Let's get more polygon count. Let's get higher graphics. As a avid video game player, it seemed to me, and to a lot of other people, that the story, or if your game didn't have a story, the gameplay of your video game was going down as the budgets stayed the same, yet more of the budget was pushed towards graphic and less towards storytelling. Yeah. But the same thing happened in comic books too, because you had the age of like Rob Liefeld. Now, Rob Liefeld was a person who is very, very popular. His art is terrible, and he's a terrible comic book creator. But as a business, he sold a hell of a lot of comics. Yeah. And so he was very successful, whether we like him or not. But what he said is that the story isn't important. It's all about the art. He's like, it's, you know,
George Lucas said the same thing about special effects. It didn't really affect the first Star Wars trilogy because he was kept typically at arm's length from its production.
Well, until he re-released it with a terrible ass.
Well, yeah, but then when he came back and re-released it, you see it more in like Temple of Doom. And then, of course, in the prequel trilogy, I mean, he said that it was his conclusion during the making of Empire Strikes Back that he said, I don't have to make a good movie just so long as I make something that's really visually spectacular, which is interesting because if memory serves, Empire Strikes Back is not only typically regarded as the deepest and most thought-provoking of the series, it was also the one where the director threw him off the set.
Yeah.
And, yes, that's true.
But yeah, let me ask you some questions.
Well, you know, on that too, though, we sit around, and when I say we, I don't mean the royal we of everybody on the planet. I mean we as in, like, you, Steve, and then the four of us sitting around here. Mm-hmm. We are very critical people. We are big nerds. We really get into...
Speak for yourself, don't you?
lady... Watch it over there. I've seen pictures of you in Battlestar Galactica costumes. Yes. So we have very critical tastes. And, you know, we look for a certain level of refinement, not in wine or a fine cigar, but in video games, comic books, movies, and wine and cigars, too, because we're sure into that as well. But we look at things like Star Wars. You know, we may enjoy it, but we say, oh, you know, yes, it's a big spectacular thing. And there was a point in the different Star Wars movies where the writing really fell off the rails, or video games where there was this big push for graphics. And again, writing, story, or gameplay fell off the rails. And, oh, you know, that's terrible. Guess what? These things sold, man. These sure things made a hell of a lot of money. Rob Liefeld, as much as you want to slap him for what he said and what he did, made a lot of bank.
Not only that, but through that success, encouraged other people to sort of follow in his wake, and then created mm-hmm this whole culture and this art style where, you know, you can have somebody like Professor X, who was a wheelchair bound mentalist, and you can see every muscle in his bicep, and you're like, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, that seems incongruous. And that's about the time that I gave up on comics, and I thought, I can't be part of this general current that's going on anymore. And thankfully, that's turned around a little bit somewhat. But yeah, I totally agree with you. The success of somebody like that then breeds imitators, and then it begins to gather momentum, and suddenly the entire field is dominated by that kind of approach.
I have to think there's going to be a point where this starts to shoot back the other direction.
I think it already has.
And I think part of what's going to drive that is diminishing returns. I don't yet own a current gen console. I don't have an Xbox One or a PS4 yet.
X-Bone. I love that name. I don't know why.
But
great. Somebody really screwed up in their PR department.
But having looked at something that's been kind of floating around the internet, somebody took a 3D model of a bust of, it was either Mozart or Beethoven, I forget which. Mm-hmm. And they showed this bust constructed out of 6 polygons, 60 polygons, 600 polygons, 6,000 polygons, mm-hmm, 60,000 polygons. It just kept upping the number of polygons in the rendering. And there's obviously a huge jump between the 6 polygons and the 60 polygons. The 6 polygons, you can't tell what you're looking at. At 60, it looks pretty crappy, but you understand what it is. At 600, it starts to look a lot more realistic. But there comes this point between the top 2 or 3 where you really can't tell a difference. Yeah, you get the diminishing returns. And so I have to think there's going to come a point where, look, you can only make an explosion so spectacular and a character look so realistic without either A, falling into the uncanny valley, or B, hitting photorealism. Either way, you're stuck, that they're going to have to find other ways to improve these games, which I hope will be in the area of story, narrative, character development, player control, so on and so forth.
And I think that they already have done that. Obviously, when we say video games are a large breadth. For every one or two really good video games we talk about, there's hundreds that are terrible. Sure. But I personally have seen that swing already go back. I mean, I brought up Borderlands 2. Borderlands 2 is a perfect example of this. You know, the level of graphics is lowered, but they took the graphics and they made them unique and interesting with their style.
World of Warcraft.
But the story is great. The sure stories are top notch in it. You look at a game like Elder Scrolls game, the latest one that comes out, graphics are great in it. You know, granted, it's a white, snowy wasteland that looks very much the same, but it is a very beautiful white, snowy wasteland that looks very much the same. But the stories within it are really good, even if you don't care for the game. I like the game myself. And then, you know, you can go on and on and on, but I think that they have done that. Now, what I find interesting too is to kind of wheel this truck way back around to, oh yeah, we're a role-playing game podcast, is do you guys see this in tabletop role-playing games? Because I do, as far as like the products go. It has become less about stories and more about killing and loot. I think that it's gone in cycles, because I think that you had in the 90s, Shadowrun, you had Vampire the Masquerade, you had games like that that were very much about story And there was a lot of books behind it, a lot of fluff, if you will. And there was also a level of combat stuff, that sort of thing. But D&D came out, and our favorite advertisement that Dan and I saw was kill more stuff, get more loot.
Kill bigger monsters, get more loot. Yeah.
Better loot.
And I don't think so, and here's why. And this actually leads into a question that I was going to ask Steve. I'm going to go ahead and ask the question, but then I'm going to tie it back to role-playing games, which is, Steve, right now, obviously through Steam, through the Xbox Arcade, there's a real enabling and revival, or perhaps, I don't know, maybe it's not a revival, maybe this is a birth, of a meaningful indie game scene within video games, where they have the tools, the hardware, and whatnot, where two or three people can sit down in a bedroom and can make something like Minecraft.
Or babies.
And I'm...
I don't know. You said bedroom, man.
Fair enough.
Like I'm just thinking about three people making babies. That seems, I'm not sure how that works.
Tag team? I don't know.
Make a video game.
Yeah.
Make a video game to explain that, yeah. But here's my question. And before I draw us back to role-playing games, Steve, do you feel that that is making any kind of a meaningful impact on video gaming as a hobby up to the level of influencing the AAA titles?
I don't know how much it's influencing the AAA titles. I know that the AAA publishers are taking note of it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the easy availability these days of digital delivery platforms like Steam and the easy availability of crowdsource funding through things like Kickstarter make it easier for people to sit down with a team of two or three folks and make something like Temple Run or Gone Home or Hotline Miami, FTL. I mean, some of my favorite games of the last few years. And I absolutely do see that happening in the printed game space as well. I mean, there are plenty of Kickstarters for either nostalgia products or new things that people want to do. And, you know, everybody has a tablet now, so you don't necessarily need to print a physical book for people to enjoy the game. And I have a lot of the RPGs that I've bought have been digital copies lately. So I think they are sort of sharing the benefits of the internet and sort of the new technology platforms that we're engaging with.
Yeah, and Chad, that was going to be my point with role-playing games, is I think that you're absolutely right that the mainstream publishing of role-playing games goes in cycles where it started off very much as the kill monsters, they explode into loot, pick up their stuff.
Yeah.
And you saw that reflected in video games, you know, ranging from Diablo to all the way back to the gold box games and the original Bard's Tale.
You know, I love that in a video game because I don't have to sit there and do the algebra.
Right. but the point
video game does
though,
it for me.
Then you had kind of a push the other direction where you had a lot of the storytelling games. You know, you named World of Darkness, which is probably the best example. And they made some attempt to translate that into video games, some of which went better than others. I mean, was the one particular Bloodlines, you know, was a great video game.
Once you get the proper fan patches for it, it's great. Well, it's broken. It's got a lot of bugs.
Yeah,
in it.
Fair enough.
But
all right. But the
so
point
good.
Being, though, if you look at role-playing games, yeah, there are still games out there where that's what they're all about. You do the dungeon crawl, you kill the monsters to get the loot. Fine. No such thing as bad, wrong, fun. Some of this you see in the old school revolution sort of games. And I'm not saying all of them. I'm not painting with a broad brush. If you're part of OSR, don't feel you need to defend yourself because you're not being attacked. But my point being,
I'll attack him. I'll slap him in the face.
But my point being, let's look at what else is going on.
Yeah.
Inspectors just successfully funded a movie. Inspectors is doing really well. Inspectors is hardly, within the role-playing game industry, a AAA title. And I realize the role-playing game industry is a rounding error of the video game industry. But nonetheless, the point is, that was hardly some major title by a company like WotC or something like that. Let's look at Fate. Well, nowadays, Fate's a household name within tabletop role-playing. Fate was an underground indie system based loosely on the open-source Fudge system that kind of came out of nowhere with Spirit of the Century and such. And yet, here's a really big storytelling system to the point that you might have only half a dozen or a dozen numbers on the character sheet. Most of what you have is adjectives. And these are games that are doing extraordinarily well, despite the fact that, yes, there are still games out there that really do push the more traditional, let's go back to the pre-D&D game of chainmail, you know, sort of model of gaming.
One of the reasons why the indie games are coming around are picking up big titles like Dresden Files or the Serenity game. The systems you would never know about, but they pick up these big names. And then
the big IPs.
Yeah, and then we're all like, oh, look at this new system, you know? And it's not new. It's just new to you because you picked it up because it was Dresden Files or Serenity. Mm. Or there's a Dragon Age role-playing game that just came out, you know? So I think that that's one of the reasons why these indie ones are coming up so hard and fast right now.
Yeah, I think that definitely gets you in the door. I don't know that it keeps you in the house unless the system is also good. But it definitely does a lot to get your attention initially. I think the problem for big publishers, like, just to bring it back around to video games, like Activision, are that, you know, they have to leverage a significant investment in the titles they're producing. And if they don't iterate on those titles on a regular basis, somebody's going to come in and deliver a similar experience and basically eat their lunch. Mm-hmm. And at that level of investment, they don't have enough tolerance for risk to be able to take the chances that a small mom and pop operation or a small group of friends who decide, hey, we really like these house rules we've come up with, why don't we publish a book? You know, big companies can't really tolerate that because they're beholden to investors and they have these other priorities that they have to serve on a regular basis, or else they get eclipsed in the market.
Yeah, let me hold on video games there for a second and ask you a question. I don't know how able you are to answer this. Do you feel, in your opinion, that video games have reached a point where, because of the amount of money involved, that really they are more beholden to the suits making risk reward sort of decisions, as opposed to what really gamers want, or I don't know, would make for better gameplay, better art, whatever you want to call it? But do you feel the whole thing has become kind of imprisoned to a corporate mentality that tabletop role playing has simply remained too small, that with the possible exception of WotC, to really fall under that kind of sway?
I suppose so. Yeah, I wouldn't pretend to speak with any great authority based on inside knowledge of how they assign those risks internally. But from the outside, at least from my perspective, that seems to be the case, which allows people to come in and offer something that is a true alternative and generate tremendous success through word of mouth and just referrals from friends, in the absence of the multi-million dollar marketing budget of a game like Call of Duty or GTA 5, which are super fun and sell really well for a reason. It's like we were talking about with comics earlier. Like, if that style wasn't enjoyed by a lot of people, then it'd be easier to say there's not anything good there.
Right.
But obviously somebody gets something out of it. So for all my complaints about iterative game design and copycat and the serialization or annualization of franchises, these companies wouldn't be making these games this way and following this business model if it didn't pay off ultimately.
Yeah. And people kind of complain, like you're saying, about the copycat thing. And, you know, if we're talking that this is art, then yes, it's like, oh, yes, they're not, you know, being true to their art. They're not being original and that sort of thing. But you mentioned GTA 5, and I think of like the iterative sort of game design with that. I love open world sandbox games where you can drive cars around cities and stuff, commit crimes, all that sort of thing. So to me, it's not a matter of, oh, well, they made this other game that's just like it, and how dare they do that? It's like, no, now instead of a meal, I have a buffet, because I love GTA 5, and I love Saints Row, and I love Driver, and I love, well, the old Drivers, and, you know, I love these sort of games. So it's like, oh, it's not even a matter of choice. It's just like, I get all I can take of this sort of style of game.
And told in different ways, too.
Yeah, and told
so it still seems new.
Yeah. GTA 5, you know, it's got a lot of serious stuff, and it, you know, got a little bit of comedy, and there's a lot of darkness to it. Saints Row, after a certain point, it's very silly, it's very over the top, it's really very Saints Row, and, you know.
I think maybe that discussion is thrown into sharper relief in the games industry because there's such a technological leap over the course of a few years for these titles that have been around forever. You know, something like Madden would be a great example. It's been around for 20 plus years. But in the tabletop world, particularly with Dungeons & Dragons, you have really, really strong alliances towards particular editions. And people say, no, I really like third edition, or I won't play anything that isn't AD&D or whatever. Like myself, when I got back into the hobby several years ago, began playing again with the third editions of D&D, and I felt like, this is not the game that I remember anymore, and I don't like what it's become. And maybe you guys can tell me from your perspective. My perception was that, you know, Wizards of the Coast, coming off of Magic the Gathering, which was very power focused and very explicit in terms of the abilities, and also seeing the tremendous success in the video game world, thought, let's just translate some of those concepts to our tabletop game. And suddenly you have a fighter who's not just good at fighting, but actually has superpowers that break the rules of the game.
I think I'd push it out another edition. What I saw with 3E, especially having talked to some of the people that designed 3E, was really what they were trying to do was simplify the rules and balance the classes a little better. Mm-hmm. And I say simplify the rules because, for example, in second edition D&D, did you need to roll under or roll above? How exactly did you calculate? I mean, the math had no consistency. Rules were scattered all over the place. Classes were not balanced, which in turn was balanced by giving them different XP progression charts and so on and so forth. And so they were trying to do it. And of course, when they got to the fighter, it's like, well, the wizard has spells that blow up cities. What can we give the fighter? And it came down to, we have to give them these feats that defy anything but wire foo. Mm-hmm. And I
you get a lot better role-playing games that simulate wire foo.
It's just for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it really struck me more that that occurred in 4E. But I think you are correct. And this is one of the points that I wanted to talk about, is how video games and role-playing games inform each other so heavily. And I've got to think that this is from two causes. One is the fact that you have an overlap in the types of people that play them. Most people that play role-playing games play video games, and some people that play video games play role-playing games. But secondly is the fact that in many cases, they're trying to tell similar stories in similar ways, mm-hmm. especially when you look at how much fantasy is borrowed so heavily from tabletop role-playing games. But when you start off with the role-playing games, I mean, you're talking D&D Red Box in 1974, the popularization of video gaming as an accessible home entertainment option really around 1980, give or take a few years. So it's several years later. You can clearly see the influences of D&D in particular all over video games. In fact, I got into role-playing games through a video game. It was playing the game The Crescent Hawk's Inception, which was the very first Battletech video game. And that game came with a FASA catalog. And looking through that FASA catalog, I got taken in by all the neat pictures and all the neat art and all the idea of imagining I could do this or that. And from that got the Star Trek role-playing game, and then Shadowrun, and then Battletech itself. Mm-hmm. That cycle still seems to be in place. And you had a kind of an unfortunate period, I feel, that we seem to be pulling out of. But especially over the past few years, the success of things like MMOs and such did not go unnoticed by people within the role-playing industry. And many role-playing games, unfortunately, began to emulate what video games were doing. Well, the thing is, just as a video game cannot emulate, at least yet, the fully emergent, nearly infinite thinking of a game master, a role-playing game cannot cleanly represent the math and loot tables, and in some cases, very complex equations that go into balancing a game like World of Warcraft.
Right.
And
tabletop role-playing game doesn't have a relational database backing it
and
up.
I'm not bagging 4E. If you enjoy 4E, more power to you. But look, let's be honest. 4E, I mean, with its little powers you fire and your rotations you do, I mean, come on, it's a video game. It's a video game
that's like you're playing Final Fantasy.
Yes, and
turn-based.
And it might have a great story, and maybe you're having deep role play with it. I'm not saying you're not or you can't, but I think to deny what it is at its core, I think would be disingenuous. And it seems like, though, that now you're kind of getting, once again, this sort of push the other direction, where video games are starting to become influenced again by role-playing games. You know, for example, I mentioned earlier in the episode, you had Pathfinder Online coming out, which is, of course, heavily influenced by at least the setting and the basic rules architecture of Pathfinder. You know, you have things like Shadowrun Returns coming out, which, while it's simplified, is still using the basic mechanics of the now catalyst-based Shadowrun system. Could go down a number of systems like that. I don't know if they'll ever be able to figure out how to do Fate until they come up with an AI. But I don't know how you roll up a character with adjectives. Somebody, I'm sure, is thinking about this right now. But you know, you can see, nonetheless, throughout the history, there's this really symbiotic relationship between tabletop role-playing games and video games in general, particularly role-playing-based video games. But I think even video games in general, because of the fact that there's an abstracted math layer to it, that in many cases you can find parallels in tabletop games, even if not RPGs, at least board games or war games.
Well, when you have a role-play, a tabletop role-playing game, and then you make a video game that is based on a tabletop role-playing game, like the early video games were Final Fantasy. I mean, one was totally and absolutely based on tabletop role-playing games. I have no doubt about it. You know, you make that transition, you lose a little something. You gain a lot, but you lose a little something. So when tabletop games are trying to translate back out the role-playing game aspects from a video game, again, you're losing something in the translation. So, I don't know. You should go for a more pure form of just, I don't know, stop copying things and be yourself. A novel approach, I know.
I agree with that, but I still think there is some value, though, in borrowing things. Part of my investment in, let me give you two relatively recent titles, XCOM, Enemy Unknown, the XCOM reboot. I would not have cared half as much as I did about that game, a quarter of much as I did about that game, if they had not had the customization mm-hmm. of the troops in there.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I look at something like Mass Effect. Okay, granted, they Jackie in the end of game 3, but what kept me so invested in that series was, even though I had a limited wheel of dialogue options and a pretty, you know, finite set of trees to work through. There's a big set of decision trees, but still quite finite compared to a tabletop role-playing game. Some part of me felt like I was Commander Shepard. You know, I got to pick what he or she looked like and what he or she did and how they fit into the world and how they balance some of the difficult political situations and how he or she made value judgments and things like that.
I cried when Alistair broke up with me in Dragon Age 1.
Spoilers.
Dead
spoilers.
Serious. Hey. That's not a spoiler. I was an elf. He wouldn't have sex with me. That was that.
Damn, what a racist.
You know, I totally understand what you're saying, though. You get into that character.
Yes.
And even though it's only a couple decisions you make and you create relationships, you still get
into it. I do agree with you that you have to accept that these are their own storytelling styles. Mm-hmm. A tabletop role-playing game is a tabletop role-playing game. A video game is a video game. At least with the technologies in place right now, these are not going to reach singularity. You have to accept that truth. But having said that, I don't think there's harm in them borrowing the best and most portable ideas from each other.
I think it would be great if they would borrow the IPs
from them.
You know, XCOM tabletop role-playing game.
Or strategy game, yeah.
You know, I say that. You know, I say that it's just like, oh, well, they should do that. Screw that. Make your own. I mean,
I disagree.
When you're talking about, I really like BattleTech.
Okay.
So, but I really like video games. So I'm going to make a video game of BattleTech. Well, that's kind of a tall order that's outside of my wheelhouse here. But if there's a video game, we'll say XCOM, because that's what we're talking about.
Okay, sure.
And I want to play a tabletop role-playing game version of that. There's a lot of different approaches that are totally realistically within my ability to do. I could come up with a system, ground up, all by myself, make it, do it, whatever.
Sure.
Or I could take an existing Fate, Fudge, D&D, Roll 20, whatever, any of the 10,000 billion systems out there. You can pick any one of them and then slap XCOM on top of that and play it. I don't know. I feel like we were debating something, but I don't remember what I was arguing with you about.
IP borrowing.
IP borrowing goes from the IP to the tabletop much easier than tabletop.
Well, I will say once again, you have to accept that you're not going to have the same experience. If I create an XCOM role-playing game or tabletop strategy game, mm-hmm. it is not going to perfectly recapture the experience of playing the video game.
Nor should it.
Let me take a better example.
Until we get our holo table, you know, Star Trek holo table, it's just not going
to
happen.
Well, let me give you an example that hits closer to home for me, which is the current MechWarrior video game that's out there, the MechWarrior Online game. You know, I'm a huge BattleTech fan. When that game came out, I mean, I was absolutely gaga for it. And then once I got into it and realized all the balancing decisions they were having to make, that took that game further and further and further from its tabletop roots. And every patch, it takes another step away from its tabletop roots. Pretty soon it came down to, you know, I'm piloting big robots mm-hmm. that look like the mechs I see in my technical readout. I'm not playing BattleTech anymore.
And the problem was never they made a bad game decision. They made good gameplay decisions. For a video game that took it away from its IP.
I think a great example of that, just in my own personal experience, is Crimson Skies, the old FOSSA game, where, you know, Jordan Weissman actually mm-hmm. made a tabletop game because he wanted to make a video game and thought of this as an opportunity for him to test out a lot of the ideas, see if it worked, see if people got it, and take some risks and try some experiments in a forum in which there's far less risk. And if you screw something up, great, just throw that piece of paper away and start again, as opposed to putting in, you know, months and months of development time. And that PC game came out and I loved it. It was my favorite game of that
first one.
Yeah, the first one.
The first one I didn't really care for. I mean, you know, I think I didn't care for it simply
because... This podcast
because,
is over.
I think I didn't care for it because I came to it after it had been out a couple of years and it didn't quite age that well. But the second one, which I think was on Xbox Live only, I could be wrong.
There was one on Xbox.
Oh, man, that was so good.
Well, I tell you...
So much fun.
It's kind of funny you say that because I did not know its history was he was shooting to make a video game. But one of the things that Chad and I saw when that game came out is he and I both looked at it and like simultaneously looked at each other and said, you know, this shouldn't be a role-playing game. This should be a video game.
Right.
And my disappointment with Crimson Skies is what I really wanted to see out of it was a scenario-based co-op game. Think kind of like what they've done with the Gears of War series, where you and three of your buddies form a little squadron. You've got a mission or, hey, an open world, whatever. You take off from your airship. You go shoot down somebody else's airship. You go be the good guy, be the bad guy, whatever it is you want to do. And unfortunately, the technology wasn't quite there by the time that the video game series died off. And that is one of my great disappointments of things that should have been but never was.
Well, my disappointment with that series came actually with High Road to Revenge, the console version of the game, because they took out
We're kicking you off the podcast.
they took out so much of the customization. So suddenly I wasn't flying my plane anymore. And this is true of BattleTech as well. I want to get in and pilot a mech based on the values that I bring to the table and the expectations that I have for how I want to play that game. And in the PC version of the game, that was very apparent to me, less so in the console version of the game.
Yeah.
And for me, that gets down to, I think we were talking earlier about a lot of people who are interested in tabletop RPGs also happen to overlap with people who are interested in computer RPGs. For me, it's about that power fantasy, that escapism, not in a pejorative sense, but just in a really fulfilling, sort of satisfying way. Mm-hmm. And you're engaging in that not as a voyeur as you would in a novel or a TV show or a movie, but as a participant, right? And I want to see the results of my participation in that. Yeah. And in some games, you don't get that. MMOs are a great example. For many years, you know, you would log into Star Wars Galaxies and you'd steal some TIE fighter plans and nothing changed.
Yeah.
Nothing ever changed in the world. And I felt like I'm clearly not a hero here. I'm just kind of grinding against this this challenge that's never going to result in any change in anybody's life or even my own character's experience, except maybe X-Wing parts are 10% cheaper the next time I go to this guy's shop.
Yeah.
And that to me is really discouraging and really depressing. And I'm glad that games have sort of added morality elements. You know, I guess the first most popular examples are games like Fable or Knights of the Old Republic. But even there, I mean, the choices were very binary. You know, are you the good guy or are you the bad guy?
Yeah, you're either the absolute white knight paladin or you're the evil mustache twirling.
They did get a little bit better with that in, I guess it was Fable 3.
Oh, yeah.
Where you had not only were good, evil, and neutral all playable options, but you also had other axes that you were working on, like wealth and poverty. And
the best one I've ever seen in my whole life was Dragon Age. Dragon Age nailed it because you weren't good or evil.
Yeah.
You made decisions. For whatever reason you made them, the game did not judge you.
An adult personal relationship.
But the relationships of the people around you based on their moralities, which were all different because they all had their own motivations because they're all well-written characters, your decisions affected how they treated you. And they nailed it really well.
Yeah, and I thought, well, perhaps not quite as good as that. Fallout New Vegas did a pretty good job as well where they had morality, fame, and then reputation with various factions and characters. And all those things kind of figured together to
it didn't get your really place come in. Out. It had that, yes, and I liked it, yes, but it didn't really come out because I felt that Fallout New Vegas was so gonzo. You know, it was so over, all that stuff was so overshadowed by all this other crazy, really good, enjoyable stuff that was going
on. Right.
Well, one thing they did in Fallout that I really did like is we talked about games like KOTOR where the morality system is very binary. And once you make that first decision, well, you know what your next 10 decisions are going to be because you're heading in the direction of being the good guy or the bad guy. And in Fallout, they actually had rival groups come attack you the farther you got along either end of that spectrum. So there was actually a reason also in that game to kind of play it safe and be in the middle and not be too bad or too good. And I really like that. That to me suddenly opened up the field for me to feel like I can really role play this character and not just say, I want to get the top tier power on the good guy side, so I have to only make good decisions for the rest of the game.
In closing this one out, I got a couple questions here I want to ask you.
Sure.
First off, there are people I know that are listening to this podcast who are interested in getting into one of the many aspects of the video gaming industry. And I want to take this from the avenue that you uniquely represent, which is the blogging, review, and new media side. What would you recommend, other than nepotism, to someone wanting to become a blogger or game reviewer for a major video game?
No, it's nepotism.
I'm sure. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure nepotism is the slam dunk. But
right.
Assuming you're not roomies with or related to or best friends with
sure.
You know, someone already at the top, what advice would you have? I mean, being the editor-in-chief, I'm sure you bring people on board. What do you look for?
Sure. We are first and foremost looking for somebody who is already doing the kind of thing we want them to do, because it has been such a democratization of publishing tools and access to blogging platforms and YouTube, and everybody has a smartphone in their pocket that they can make their own videos with, that if you're not already doing this, then there's a line of 1,000 people who already are. And I know from these people how good their work is. I know that they're enthusiastic and dedicated enough to keep doing this work. So I don't have to go on faith on either of those two criteria for those people. Whereas if you're just waiting for an opportunity, I really have to close a lot of gaps on your behalf. And I get tired. I don't like closing gaps for other people. So yeah, I would say first and foremost, if you want to be a game critic, if you want to be a game reviewer or just sort of a commentator in the games industry, that option is available to you right now. And you can go ahead and begin doing that. Don't wait. It's like they say, if you want to be a comic book artist, the first thing you do is draw. Start drawing right now and don't ever stop, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I would say to somebody who wants to do this. Start gaming right now and start commenting on games and don't ever stop. The second piece of advice would differ depending on whether you want to achieve success at a publication like IGN or if you want to go it on your own. If you want to go it on your own, I would say find a niche and fill it. Find some sort of narrow vertical that has some likelihood of staying around for the next few years and just do everything you can to absolutely dominate it. We see a lot of success on YouTube for people who are only doing one type of content. They're doing, for example, Minecraft Let's Plays, or they're doing Call of Duty kills or things like that. If you want to get a job at a publication, you have to be a lot more diversified in terms of your interests. I have people who tell me, I want to work at IGN one day. I play every wrestling game that comes out and that's all I play. And I think, well, great. Like, that's a useful tool for us to have in our tool belt, but it's only applicable to one very, very narrow circumstance. And what I want is somebody who can bring a sort of broad perspective to this industry and say, yes, this thing over here in group A reminds me of this other thing in group B, and my awareness of that allows me to bring a new sort of commentary or a new perspective to what's happening with thing A. That's another reason I wanted to start playing analog games. Is because I didn't want the guys who work for me who are reviewing these games to mistake for the general pattern of gaming something that is unique in particular just to video games. So yeah. Let's expose them to other things, and then they can say, oh, I get why this is this way, because it matches the needs or the limitations of the platform. And it's like a fish not knowing it's wet, right? You have to get out of the water and see how the other half lives. I guess it's kind of a mixed metaphor, but, you know, just to expose yourself to other things. And if you want a job at IGN, that's critically important as well. The third piece of it was be a well-rounded person. I mean, just be a person. Be somebody I can talk to about sports or TV shows or history or politics or religion, because, you know, we spend 8 to 10 hours a day with each other. We may be going on junkets together and spending a week together. And if all we talk about is the new Dragon Age, that's going to get old pretty quickly.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about like the indie guys or whatever on YouTube. And I think about some of these guys on YouTube, like Diamond Minecart or Sundy or Markiplier or any of these guys. They have like just one focus. Like the Diamond Minecart guy, he's this dude in Britain. All he does really is Minecraft. And not even just Minecraft. Minecraft mods. It is a Minecraft mod review. Does one every single day. Has millions of subscribers. He makes a ton of money in ad revenue, which is great. I mean, that's awesome. That is good for him. But what happens when Minecraft really isn't that big of a deal anymore?
Right.
You know, what's the game plan there?
That's a question we ask ourselves on a regular basis. You know, it's not just about what do I need to do today, but what do we need to do to prepare IGN to be where it's going to need to be in 3 to 5 years? 10 years ago, internet video was not really that big a deal. And so we didn't have a lot of resources invested in that. But over the last 10 years, it's become a critical part of our business. So you have to diversify. You have to set yourself up as a publishing platform and as a staff to be nimble enough and broad enough in terms of your strengths that you can go where the audience is going to be. And, you know, for us right now, obviously, the internet has allowed a lot of easy consumption of video. And a lot of people like content that way. And the struggle right. for me is to divorce myself from my own expectations, where if I'm stuck in a game, it's very easy for me to go to a text document and search for Secret Door or Final Boss or whatever and get my content that way. That's not the way everybody consumes content. So we need to be prepared to offer a wide range of ways for people to get it, the kinds of information they want.
In closing up this interview, there's something that we do for everyone we interview, which is I want to give you a chance to talk about what you've got coming up, either as an individual or things that are coming up at IGN that you want to make people aware of. If you guys are launching new media channels or just whatever. So what's coming up that you want to draw the attention of our audience to?
Well, I mean, we've got a huge slate of games coming out this holiday season, and we're sort of watching as that avalanche begins to tumble down on us right now. The summer for us is a show season. So we just got back from Comic-Con. We're going to Gamescom soon and then to PAX, and we're going to be at all these shows. We're going to have panels. We're going to be doing live streams from some of them as well. So you can check out that content on IGN. And then it's really just everybody put their heads down. Let's get through review season and then start speculating on what we need to cover in 2015.
Awesome. All right, so if you want to check out any of that stuff, if you guys are not already familiar with the site, it's IGN.com, which stands for I Got Nepotism.
Perfect. Perfect. It does now.
Yes.
Editor-in-Chief Steve Teehee Butts. And no, seriously, Steve, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. It was great having a chance to interact with you and you know, talk about kind of that overlap between role-playing games and video games, which I believe not only in terms of creativity have heavily influenced each other, but obviously there's a very big overlap in terms of the audiences. And I know some people are exclusively one or the other, but there are a lot of people that are currently active in or at least interested in both of these. So I think it's always neat to talk about how these influence each other. So thank you very much for joining us. Yeah.
Well, you're very grateful. I'm happy the opportunity. I've been a big fan of Fear the Boot just for a few months now, but have consumed a lot of your content. And I love your approach to the subject. And I'm grateful that we live now in a society that values the types of things we're interested in enough that we can sit around and have a discussion about it that people actually pay attention to.
Yeah, actually, that is a great thing. And also the worst thing about new media is whether you have one fan or a million fans, the cost is the same and anybody can do it. Which allows people like us and also allows some shows that have long gone that I won't even name. So anyway, thank you guys at home for tuning in. I hope you got something out of this episode. As always, have a great week and great games. And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.